Godgy good day, Melisande Stokes. 'Tis been a pleasure to serve with you. Fare thee well. Even as she spoke, the room began to dim and tilt about me, and the lovely aroma that always wafted at the edges of my attention when I was sent. I smelled it. And then? And then I awoke 3 weeks ago, naked, cold, on the grimy pavers of a London street at dawn, frantic to know what date it was, like a perversion of Scrooge at the end of A Christmas Carol, which came out less than a decade ago. To make short shrift of it, a beadle was called and I was bundled off to Bedlam, but a physician there sensed there was something different about me, thank God, and brought me to his home, for he and his wife to try to salvage. They have it almost right. They take me for a witch. There are witches in distant branches of his family, and he has watched with compassion as several of them have fallen into despair as their powers waned. One took her own life. So they have offered me shelter, food, the clothes upon my back, on the sole condition that I make no attempt to communicate with any witch in any way. Not that I know any witches in 1851 London anyhow. And even if I did, it would be a miracle if she had the power left to send me forward before the eclipse, which will occur in just 17 days.
Post by Mortimer Shore on General Grimnir Channel. Day 1947, Black Friday, Year 5.
Mortimer here, writing first entry on new Grimnir system from safe locale. Okay, so those of you who are into the Norse mythology might have read a story about Odin disguising himself as a regular mortal for tactical reasons. The name he adopted was Grimnir. The old Odin system is no longer accessible to me. They have changed the passwords and kicked me out. I'm on the outs, and on the run with a few of the others. But I set up a new system on the dark net that we can use to stay in touch with each other and make a record of all that's happening. And I'm calling it Grimnir. I'm not much of a narrative writer, but here's what has gone down. 2 days ago, on Wednesday afternoon, the day before Thanksgiving, after some delays, Mel and Grania were sent to the 1850 San Francisco DTAP, supposedly to recruit a Chinese KCW there. The old school Odex don't have enough room inside of them for a sending witch and two doers, so this was a dual send from Addo number 1, which has plenty of room on the interior. By that point, it had been hoisted up and mounted on the back of its tractor-trailer rig, making it ready for field trials on the streets of the greater Boston area beginning Friday. This was billed as a one-day deed, or possibly a one-nighter, but as I said, it got off to a late start, and by the time they were going into the Addo, Mel was resigned to the fact that it was probably going to wipe out most of Thanksgiving Day, and that she'd take Friday off instead. At the same time, Wednesday, there was a lot of bureaucratic back and forth involving Tristan, Ersebet, and Blevins regarding this unusual deed that had been planned for Tristan starting Friday morning, where he was being sent back to 20,000 BC Germany. Ersebet was all like, "I am only following orders, like the indentured servant I have been since I met you." And so it was up to Tristan to verify and double-check the order with Blevins and interface with the Chronotron crew. Gordon Healy, one of the Chronotron nerds, ended up staying late and missing his flight home as he tried to help make sense of the mission and dig up the background information that Tristan needed to prep for it. He and Ersebet booked a slot on Odec number 1 early on Friday morning, that's today, since the Odecs were already fully booked for the rest of the day and the Addo would not be available. I volunteered to come in and run the control panel. So we arrived this morning about an hour before the rest of the staff was due in. Tristan had slept well, although he still looked a little ruffled about this strange assignment. Like I said, 20,000 BC. Dude. Ersebet had a look of sort of grim resignation to her, but that's not too unusual for her. We checked the logs to see if Grania and Mel had made it back, but there was no sign of them. A little unusual, but nothing that would really raise a red flag yet. I sit on the outside of the glass wall to run the controls. Ersebet and Tristan went through the usual protocols in the biocontainment ward, while I got the ODEC number 1 powered up and ran the usual checks. Through the glass wall, I saw Tristan come out of the sterilization suite in the usual bathrobe. He tossed me a salute and walked into the ODEC. Ersebet began to follow him in. Then she hesitated mid-stride and stepped back away from it. For a long moment, she stared into the ODEC. She kind of looked a little queasy. I turned on the intercom and asked if there was a problem. "Come on, Ersebet," I heard Tristan say.
"You will come out of there," she said.
"What?"
"I say you will come out of there, very quickly. I must tell you something."
A sound, nearly a harumph, and then Tristan came out of the ODEC. Ersebet closed the door behind him, and then visibly relaxed. I hadn't realized she had been tense until I saw the tension leave her shoulders. "All right," said Tristan, bemused. "What's going on?"
"There is no real assignment to send you on this deed," she said.
Tristan was totally still for a moment, and then pursed his lips together until they were colorless. "What?" he said at last.
"It is all faked. Every bit of it. It is all part of a scheme."
"What scheme? Who's behind it?" She looked troubled, but resigned.
"The scheme requires getting rid of Melisande and yourself. Melisande is gone forever, and now I am supposed to get rid of you."
The look on Tristan's face was of even greater shock than I myself was feeling, which is saying a lot. "But Mel's with," he protested.
"It is Grania's scheme," said Ersebet. "It was almost mine as well. But I have been awake all night thinking of Melisande, and it is wrong to do this. So I am not doing it."
There was complete silence in the chamber except for the background hum of the ODEC.
"I do not want to do this anymore,"
she continued, sounding almost plaintive, which if you've ever heard Ersebet speak is a hard thing to imagine.
"I am quitting. I will leave and do something else."
Tristan had closed his hand around her wrist and was trembling with the effort of not shaking her. "What's happened to Mel? What is Grania doing? Explain yourself." She looked cowed, or at least as close to cowed as Ersebet Carpety could ever look.
"She wants to take over Dodo and use it for her purposes," she said in a strangely small voice. "From San Francisco. She has already sent Mel somewhere else, someplace Mel will not be able to come back from."
"Where? When?" She avoided his gaze.
"We agreed not to tell each other what we were doing. Like the French Resistance, it is safer not to know."
"How the fuck is this like the French Resistance?" Tristan growled, looking angrier than I've ever seen him. He let go of her and walked away, muttering to himself. Ersebet's face had flushed such a bright shade of red that she was almost unrecognizable. I'd never known until this moment that she was capable of being embarrassed.
"I know, of course," she looked at Tristan. "And if you think about it, so do you. You have always known where Mel would end up."
Tristan turned and looked at her, his anger suddenly replaced by a look that said, "Of course, I get it." "London," he said. 1851.
"Yes, we can speak more of it later. But today, Grania will be back from 1850 San Francisco," said Ersebet. "She has Blevins wrapped around her pinky finger. Frink, too. She also has the affection of Mr. Shiny Face Gordon Healy. She tried to seduce Mortimer, but she says he is too much of a nerd."
"Geek," I corrected. "I'm a geek. If I were a nerd, she'd have me in bed by now."
"There are other people," said Ersebet. "I do not know all of them."
Tristan's face still showed blank astonishment. "But what's her goal? What does she want?"
"She wants magic not to go away," said Ersebet. "That is not the same thing as letting it go away and then bringing it back."
"Holy shit," said Tristan under his breath. And then, as the full implication of this hit him, he repeated it much louder. "Holy shit!"
"I will leave," said Ersebet, with nervous decisiveness. "It is best if you leave too, Tristan Lyons."
"You're not going anywhere without me," said Tristan. Not until you've told me everything you know. Ersabet's breathing suddenly seemed labored, as if it were dawning on her that she couldn't casually walk away from her aborted mission.
I've already told you almost everything, but I will stay with you until we figure out how to help Melisande.
Damn right you will, said Tristan.
That is my choice, she informed him,
rebounding back to the fierce and scornful witch around whom we all love to walk on eggshells.
Do not treat me like I do not have a choice in this. It was my choice right now not to send you back to the Ice Age. I could have done it like that.
She snapped her fingers for emphasis.
Do not treat me like I have done something wrong. I have done something right. You will appreciate that, or I will walk away.
Tristan collected himself. Okay, he said, you're right. Thank you for not annihilating me when you had the chance. I realize that maybe wasn't easy for you. A brief pause as he considered options. We'll go to Frank Oda's house and bring him up to date. He turned to me. You're logged in as being here with us right now. If we disappear, they'll want to know what you know. You should probably get out of here with us.
We have an hour, I pointed out.
What do you mean? Tristan asked.
I'd already punched in the commands to power down the ODEC. Grania can't come back until at least one of the ODECs is turned on for her.
I was checking out the day's schedule on a monitor. Earliest that could happen is an hour from now. During that time, I'll get as much intel as I can and get it out of the building. And because Tristan hesitated,
I'm on Team Oda. I don't care about the rest of it.
We should go, said Ersabet to Tristan,
heading back into the biocontainment ward, which was the only way out.
Everyone arrive soon. Let's be far away.
They left. And I did some deep breathing exercises to lower my heart rate back to normal, and then went about my morning as if it were just another day, except that I also quietly plugged my biggest flash drive into my desktop computer and began to download as much of Odin as possible. The whole Odin system, all of the message threads, NDAs, HR records, deed reports, security camera video, and other bureaucratic junk that had piled up on our servers during the 5 years that Dodo had been in existence, would have filled my flash drive 1,000 times over. So I tried to be selective, searching for documents that referenced Mel, Tristan, Blevins, and other key names, and focusing on certain ranges of dates when it seemed like a lot of important shit had gone down, like Halloween. Even so, I ended up accidentally grabbing a lot of stuff like the sexual harassment policy that I didn't really want or need, but I didn't have time to be more selective. Now that it's all up on Grimnir, I can maybe go through and prune it later. I kept my head down as people came in and the office filled up as on any other day. Except that headcount was low because a lot of people were taking vacation. My cube is on the edge of the R&D group area, so I saw Dr. Oda come in and do a stand-up meeting with the crew that was going to be taking the Addo out on the road, a driver, obviously, plus a muon and two technicians who were going to be in the back, operating the equipment and running tests. Nothing too fancy. They just wanted to verify that the Addo's onboard power supply and comms features would operate nominally while the thing was bouncing around in real-world traffic conditions. My cube is also an earshot of the big open stairwell that runs up the middle of the building, and so eventually I heard Grania's voice. She had returned from the San Francisco DTAP without Mel. I heard her go up to the floor above me and enter Blevins's office. The door closed. And there were a few minutes of calm before the storm, before voices were raised, and people up there started looking stressed out. A couple of DOSECOPS personnel came up the stairs double time and blew past Blevins's receptionist into his office, and there was a lot more jawing. I was sitting there trying to be cool, watching the progress bar on my screen, wondering whether I should just yank the thumb drive and get out of there. Then the decision was made for me by a DOSECOP, who had approached me from behind, a little bit sneaky-like, and told me I was wanted in Blevins's office immediately. I made a glance toward the stairwell and saw another DOSECOP loitering there, keeping me in the corner of his eye. So I figured they had orders not to let me just bolt. So I got up and went up the stairs into Blevins's office.
He and Granio were in there with two of the higher-ranking DOSECOPS officers, including Major Isabel Sloan, who I kind of wondered if Granio had a bit of an influence over. Blevins was in his big leather swivel chair, and Granio was standing behind him, sort of hovering, and both of them were glancing between me and a monitor on Blevins' desk.
"Where be they, then?"
Granio demanded, eyes fixed on me in a way that made me feel like a prey animal. "Who?" I asked, trying to look stupid, which is actually something I'm pretty good at when I have to be.
"Where's Colonel Lyons?" demanded Blevins. "We know he and Ersebet came into the building early this morning within moments of your arrival, and that they both left a short time later."
And then Blevins pivoted the monitor around and let me see some security camera footage from earlier that morning. "Yours truly talking to Tristan and Ersebet."
I have no idea what kind of look was on my face at that moment, but I can tell you how they looked. Blevins was sort of blank-faced and unnerved, while Granio was trying to kill me with her eyes.
"Yeah, I saw them, but they had a fight about something and they both stormed out. I wasn't really paying attention because I'm a little hungover, and anyhow, those two were always bickering. I think Ersebet said she was going home."
"It's a lying bit of treachery, is this one," Granio declared.
And then I glanced down at Blevins and saw a change come over his face. I know magic can't work outside of an Odek or an Addo, and that Blevins' office was neither of those, but I swear it was like seeing a Jedi mind trick in action. Whatever Granio had done to Blevins during all of that time they'd spent together in Addo's conducting Psy-Ops research, it still worked on him somehow. Maybe it wasn't magic at all. Maybe it was just plain old psychological influence. But it was clear to me in that moment that Blevins had been reduced to a marionette.
But not a very precisely controlled one, apparently.
"You," announced Blevins with a flip of his manicured gray mane, "are fired."
"Don't be firing him now," Granio objected. "You want to be interrogating him. You're not allowed to do that if he's not yours anymore."
I caught the eye of Major Sloan, the ranking DOSECOPS officer, and I thought maybe she was taken aback a little too. So I was maybe mistaken about thinking she was Granya's minion. I pointed out, "You're not allowed to do it anyway because this is a free country, and we don't just interrogate people here. Maybe Major Sloan could explain some of the legalities." Blevins thought about it for a moment, which was fine with me. I just needed time to download as much of the Odin database as possible. Major Sloan looked back at me like she was taking the point I was making. Then Blevins called out to his admin that he wanted General Frink on the line as soon as possible to discuss a matter of national security.
"Where's Mel?" I asked Granio.
"Detained in San Francisco,"
she answered, sort of indignant, like, how dare I even? Getting Frink on the line happened incredibly quickly. Apparently he was taking the day off with family, and so he just answered his phone. The admin patched him through on voice, and Blevins went off on a rambling, bizarro version of the last couple of days' events, talking about how Mel was AWOL, and now Tristan and Ersebet were up to no good, and assumed to be on the lam with important national security secrets, and I, Mortimer, was in cahoots with them. And he couldn't just call the cops because national security this and classified that, and so he wanted to invoke special powers and procedures, and basically send out a DOSECOPS squad to round up Tristan and Ersebet and just let the chips fall where they may in terms of lawyers and arrest warrants and all of those other minor technicalities. Every so often he'd pause for breath, and General Frink would grunt into the phone like,
"Yeah, I'm still here, I'm with you, bro."
Finally, Blevins didn't so much finish up as wind down, for lack of anything more to say, and Frink says, "I'm authorizing you to mobilize the DOSECOPS Extra Facility Ops Team, and get this done as surgically as you can." Now, I'd never even heard of the EFOT before, so its existence must have been a pretty closely guarded secret. But everyone else in the room seemed to know exactly what it was. Major Sloan nodded and said,
"Already mobilized, General Frink. When I got word earlier this morning that trouble was brewing, I sent out the call. We have two squads in the ready room, fully armed and armored.
deployable on short notice.
As if reassuring herself this was the case, she unlocked her phone and scanned her eyes over some information.
Well done, Frink said over the phone.
And what is the word from our surveillance team at the East Oda residence? Blevins asked. I guess I shouldn't have been surprised they'd already covered that angle.
Sir, Professor Oda is still on the premises here, of course, said Sloane. But Colonel Lyons and Ersebet were just reported at the residence with Mrs. East Oda. Somehow they got in without being spotted, but they got careless once they were in there, and surveillance saw them in the kitchen.
What are the odds that if we go in quickly, Ifat can take them into custody without it becoming a cause celebre in the neighborhood?
Blevins asked. Depends on whether Tristan puts up a fight, said Major Sloane, but I don't imagine he would.
Very well, said Blevins. Major Sloane, I am ordering you to deploy the Ifat squads to the East Oda residence and...
He stopped in mid-sentence, a little surprised because every phone in the room had started ringing. Even mine.
And there was a bit of a funny moment just then, not ha-ha funny, when Grania clearly didn't know what to do.
Because Grania didn't have a phone,
and it was clear from the look on her face that she hadn't been expecting this interruption, whatever it was. Everyone else was looking at their phones, so I did too. And what I saw was a text from one of the R&D crew saying, OMG, is that the Addo on Channel 5? And for a second, I didn't even catch the reference. I thought he was referring to some internal top-secret communications channel. It took a minute to realize he was talking about the local television network news station. Meanwhile, there's all kinds of confusion and consternation from others in the room, everyone shouting into their phones with their fingers plugged into the other ear, Grania looking around with kind of a wild, desperate expression.
Dr. Blevins, can that thing stream live television? I asked, nodding at his computer.
I haven't the faintest idea, he said. You're the sysadmin.
Point taken, I said. Let's all trot downstairs to my workstation and I'll put up the stream. And before any orders could be issued to the contrary, I ducked out the door and headed down the stairs. Frankly, I didn't care whether they followed me or not. But when I reached my cubicle and looked back over my shoulder, I saw them all traipsing along behind me, on their phones or whatever, and all around the whole office was in pandemonium. I sat down and plucked the flash drive out of my workstation and slipped it into the little cargo pocket down on the calf section of my tactical pants, and then cleared my screen and brought up the live news feed from the local network TV station. And what we were seeing was the front of a Walmart. And the caption on the screen said it was in Lexington, Massachusetts, the same store where Magnus had hightailed it to a few weeks ago, before he'd coerced Constance Billy into sending him back to Viking Paradise or wherever. The entire front of the store, the glass entryway where they keep the shopping carts, had been punched in by a huge impact, all the windows destroyed. Embedded in the middle of all that destruction, we could see the rear of a tractor-trailer rig that had obviously just been driven straight into the front of the building at high speed and come to rest just inside the store. Looked like it had obliterated some checkout lanes en route. The rig was a common type seen around port facilities, a steel shipping container resting on the bed of a trailer. The shipping container was green with rust spots. We had all seen it before. It was the Addo. Before I could ask the question, Major Sloane, who'd been on the phone, looked up at Blevins and said, "Confirmed. We lost contact with it immediately after it left the facility. Obviously, it was hijacked."
Police radio transmissions report several large, naked Caucasian males have emerged from the shipping container and are taking hostages, said the TV reporter. Grania was the first to put it together.
"Magnus!" she hissed,
and then let fly with a torrent of rage in which I assumed was Gaelic. She's always been pretty emotional, but I'd never seen her just completely lose it before. She'd have torn Magnus apart with her fingernails if he'd been in the room.
"Major Sloane," Blevins said, "get the Ifat squads and everything else you have to that Walmart immediately."
Everyone split up. I trotted downstairs and walked out the front door and around the corner. And then I ran like a motherfucker. I just had a feeling it would be for the best. So that was the moment I went from being a geek with the coolest job a recent CS grad from MIT could ever in a thousand years hope to find, to being a renegade. A serious renegade. Anonymous has got nothing on me. That's how we ended up here at Oda's place. I'm not even sure how Frank himself got back here. I mean, there's an argument we should just get the fuck out of here and try to disappear. But one, disappearing is hard, and two, we can't just ditch the Odas, and three, we haven't violated any laws, and so there's no reason the Cambridge PD should give a crap one way or the other. Rebecca is, Natch, making us some tea. I'm not sure when she will relax her jaw muscles enough to ever open her mouth again, but that doesn't mean she wants to throw us out. We're sort of expecting Blevins will be sending someone to assassinate us, at least figuratively, very soon. Which is why I wanted to get this whole story written and uploaded.
Journal entry of Rebecca East Oda.
Friday after Thanksgiving. Day, 1947, Black Friday, year 5. Temperature, 38 degrees Fahrenheit, and never mind about the rest of it. Extraordinary development. Tristan, Azabeth, and Mortimer have taken up residence in the basement, and we presume Frank is no longer an employee of Dodo, but it's all rather disordered at the moment. The local news is airing the most remarkable story about a raid at the Lexington Walmart. Mel is stuck in 1851 London, thanks to the machinations of Grania. Tristan and Frank, immediately preoccupied with sorting out how to build a homemade O-deck in the basement so that if Mel can find a KCW, she will have a safe re-entry point to the modern day. Although, since she wouldn't know we had it, how would she know to be sent there? Never mind. Better than taking no action. Frank suggested shanghaiing one of the new Attos, toward which he has a wounded proprietary pride. Atto number 1 seems to be embedded in the aforementioned Walmart, with naked berserkers pouring out of it. But 3 others have been constructed, and 6 more are nearly complete. Mortimer is trying to set up a secure mini-intranet in our basement, as he has a flash drive called Grimnir, with an enormous amount of Odin material on it, and he wants to upload it someplace stable so that it can't fall out of one of the pockets of his ludicrous trousers. The cats have disappeared in the chaos.
The Lay of Walmart. Translator's note continued. Part 2, written in ballpoint pen on printer paper, was found in the ruins of a Walmart in suburban Boston, Massachusetts, following a bloody siege by persons described in media reports as a gang of methamphetamine addicts connected with the Russian mafia. Part 2. Inga Bjorg and those of her ilk sent me and Magnus to more ditaps than memory can contain. 22 were the reckless recruits, all renowned warriors. On Sverdvik's shore they stood, steaming, ready for the recital. Tales from Toki told many times from Magnus's memories. Mead he served to the men, full horns. Looming from a long ship's proud prow, he spoke. The ship we sail today, fighting the Fatlanders, is but a box, oarless, ordinary. Atto they name it. To it Ingabjorg sends me. It's on a great cart. Vikings love to shove ships up onto the shores of realms ready for ruin. Just so, I'll attack with the Atto, the glass gates of the Walmart. Like a dagger driving deep, not stopping till the blue-vested guard, the till-keepers, towers of trifles, the cart crushes, ramming, reaming out of its way. Furious Ingabjorg, future-fearing, by then will have sent Sturlof. Magnus's sword swung round toward he of that name, grizzled but great-framed giant killer. Sturlof recited, "Inside of the Atto are oddments, weird wares, dangerous distractions. I ignore them. brace my body on the bulkhead, ride through the ruin of the glass gates. Silence is my signal to dart to the door. From it, I face east down a wide way, vexing my vision many marvels. Ignore them. Magnus, my guide, I go where he shows me. Eastward, thence, lies victory for Vikings. Counting the cairns, the merchandise mounds. Standing in the center of the wide east-west way, stop at the sixth. Atop, it's an image. A fair lass, tresses flowing, like the lush Lindalsfallet, where it rushes over rocks, teeth shining like Snæfells Jökull. Cradled in the lass's hands, a bottle, bewitching brew, beautifying the hair. Below it many more such, stacked like soldiers. That is the landmark that leads me to the left. A long lane laden with loot. Its rune is like Berkano. The beginning, its number, 105. Let it lead me north, little more to say. For in fewer than 5 paces is what my hand has hungered for since I found myself in Fat Land, alone and naked. Numberless knives, new and needy. Furious Ingibjorg, future-fearing, by then will have brought Brand. Magnus's sword swung round toward he of that name, berserker of Zeoland, brutal and bear-like. Brand recited, vexing my vision, many marvels. Sturolf shows my way. Stop not where he does. Brand goes beyond. Count cairns thrice more. Number 9 is a doll dump. Toddler's toys, painted purple and pink, smiling like simpletons, box-bound. Brand there turns right. A long lane laden with loot. Shopkeepers screaming, pay no mind. Clashing carts may cause trouble, don't be deterred. Vikings can vault them, berserkers bash them aside. All the way to the wall goes Brand. Heaped there are hammers, axes also. Spades, saws on long shafts, all manner of death-dealers, racked and ready, or stacked like firewood on the floor. Commandeer a cart. Kill its keeper if need be. Fill it full of those death-dealers. Leave nothing that might be handy for hewing heads and severing sinews in the struggle to come. Thus the berserker, bright-eyed, blood-lusting. Furious Ingibjorg, future-fearing, by then has Hofdan sent. Magnus's sword swung round toward he of that name. White-bearded Kingslayer, lord of legend. Hofdan recited, vexing my vision many marvels. Ignoring them, I wait. Ingibjorg sends more. In the meantime, knives from Sturolf, axes and hammers from Brand harden my hand. All told, my band is 4. My companions 3 are Turolf, Bilt, and Glomar. Travel to the 10th cairn. Turn to the left. Toys stacked to the ceiling. Do not let them beguile the eye. Long lanes laden with loot. Wide ways, well made for waging war, like the roads of the red-crested Romans ordered just so, as warp and weft. Too many for merchants to memorize, marked therefore with runes they can read. Romans wrote them first. The fat ones stole them, as well as Arabs' numerals arranged below. For each district of the treasure town, a Roman rune written, raised high. For each lane lying below it, an Arabic number to know it. Their runes resemble ours often. Others are different. One's like a fishhook. That's in the northeast of the store, Norseman's native land, all the good gear. Forests of fishing poles you can see from afar, ropes for rigging, machetes for making way or bringing battle. Don't be delayed, though. Go till glass gleams on all sides. Behind those wide windows, boxes brick-sized, written with runes, stacked to the ceiling. Glass is nothing to Glamah. Hammer in hand he has at it, shears shelves, loots little boxes, carrying them in carts down long lanes to the wall of the wonder windows. Hofdan hastens down the glass-lined lane till the way to the walls barred by a counter. Behind it, bang sticks of the Fatlanders, counterkeepers looking askance. They're the only true foes we must fight at first. Don't be deceived that there's no swords at their sides. Bang sticks instead, shooting slingstones faster and more fearsome than arrows. At a distance, they're deadly. Get close, quick. For of fighting at arm's length, axe to axe, they know nothing. Rush at them right away if their hands are empty. Lie low otherwise. Hunker down, holding my tongue, till I hear Height, who's the only one who can get close to the guards when the shield maid has their attention. That's the time to burst in bravely. Thus Halfdan, gray-hamed, picked out for his patience. Magnus's sword tip, swinging this way and that, picked out each warrior, each shield maid. In turn, each told the tale, written by Toki, foretelling the future of what was to come, the doom to descend on the Fatlander's storehouse, what deeds each warrior would do, and when. Under the awning of the longship, idle till now, Ingibjorg waited, sipping stew of spotted mushrooms, eyes lazy but half in this world, fingers fondling her broom twigs. Magnus met her there, sharing the shade, smelling the scent of eldritch herbs. Gathered round the gunwales, we felt the glamour. Ingibjorg had sent him, sticks thrown, die cast.
Sturlof she sent next, blade-bringer, Brand the berserker, Halfdan the wise, Height the shield-maiden, Glama, built Turof.
Toki was taken. Ship sank from my sight. I beheld a big box, shiny steel. It must be the Ato. I darted to the door. Vexing my vision, many marvels. I ignored them. Magnus my guide. I went where he showed me. North of the nose of the great cart, the Ato-bearer, where it had crashed to a halt after driving deep, a forest of fabric, as had been foretold, clothing of all colors, made for men and women, bigger than any bazaar. Beyond that, the marvel Magnus had mentioned, too strange to speak of. Wonder windows, a wall of them. The great gift of the Fatlanders is these. Panes of perfect glass showing not what lies beyond them, but images, effigies, prophecies, wonders. Painted in piercing light, melding many hues, bright as berries, flickering like fire. Like the windows of Christian cathedrals when lanced by the light of the sun, but not frozen forever as those are. Images in movement, flashing and flitting. Toki was here to take treasure, reading the runes in those windows. North went I, wandering in the wake of the shield maiden Height. Her hair was braided in back, hanging below brushing bare buttocks. Walking behind, my gaze was beguiled. Gladly I'd go to battle behind one such as Height. She raised her arms, baring herself to a shocked shopper, a fat woman fondling fabrics. Height, heedless, elbows bent, hands swung down behind head. A knife she held there, stolen by Sturlof, sheathed safely. She stuck it into her braid where the tresses came together at the nape of her neck. Tucked in, held by her hair, until needed. Remembering Magnus, Toki took trousers, sacking a shelf load, but went onward north to the Wonder Wall. East turned Height. Toki's eyes tracked her. She broke into a run. Screams escaped from her mouth. Not war whoops, but cries of terror. Not a word of the angle speech Height spoke. No matter. The men it was meant for heard it and heeded. Height was now bound for the bang sticks. Kept in that corner were the weapons of Wall marked. Three guards gathered there, wondering what had happened. Carts crash, shoppers' screams, fleeing Flatlanders, alarm had raised. And now, alas, not a stitch on, screaming for succor, coming on at a run. What harm could she do them?
Into the arms of the first, height threw herself. Out from the braid came that blade, and into the back of his neck. As he dropped, she closed on the next, arm whirring. The third aimed his bang stick, ready to shoot, till an axe struck home in his head, hurled by Thorolf, part of Halfdan's band, running round from the long lanes marked by the rune of the fishhook. The first part of the fight was now finished. From the Ato, attackers kept coming. Osmund, Icelandic berserker, far famed. Hrani, the shipwright from Sweden. Arngrim, Jorvard, Ingvar, Snorri, mighty Tord. Magnus gave each man a task, sending them this way and that. Hostages were herded and held. Strange sheets of wood, wide and flat, formed the flanks of a new fortress wrapped and roofed in bright blue tarpaulins, lashed down with lines. The West March of the Walmart held all the food in the world, bottled beer by the boatload. Frost kept food, milk, and meat. Setting up for a siege behind barricades, the Norsemen fetched food, collected clothing. Turkish trousers, with flies in the front, kept closed with clever contraptions. Tiny teeth, meshing like millipedes' legs, gnashing, knitting, concealing the naked. Zipper, the Flatlanders called it. Cockcatcher it was to Hunfast, the hapless. Chains, padlocks, ropes of wrought steel fetched forth from the long lanes curved round the captives' necks, but all turned to the source of a sound. A big bang, like the trunk of a tree snapping in a storm, making all deaf. A Fatlander, about to be fettered and fastened to the fortress's side, had pulled out a small bang stick, concealed in his clothes, shot a stone, struck Samander, Ingvar's son, beloved brother, oar-puller, sword-swinger. He had taken on a troll once, outside of Ajar, bested him in battle, hand to hand, but the bang-stick stone had struck a lung. Samunder's life-blood gushed out of his mouth. He fell like a tall tree. Magnus took a machete, held it in the hero's hand, sent him to Valhalla. Another bang bloodied our ears. Tord cursed. A stone had struck him in the arm. A third bang as Tord threw down, thrashed the man who'd murdered Samunder, the coward who killed from afar. The stone struck no one, hewing a hole in the wooden wall, tearing the tarpaulin. Face down on the floor, the Fatlander rose not again. Murder-loving Magnus, riven by rage, grabbed an axe, swung it into the spine of the shooter, severing two ribs just by the backbone, adjusted his aim, swung again, rending the rib cage, separating the spine. The shooter's screams went silent as wind whistled through those wounds. His struggle ceased. Magnus opened the man like the spreading wings of an eagle, blood bright, lungs loose, open to the air now. A clashing cart was fetched, dumped out, making room for the murderer's remains. Magnus shoved him out through the glass gates. Fatlander's fear cries resounded. Sirens screamed. Magnus made his way back to the fast fortress we'd made around the wonder windows. Translator's note. The lay of Walmart breaks off at this point. Surveillance camera footage, combined with eyewitness accounts compiled from surviving hostages, agree that from this point onward, the author, Taki, was kept busy learning how to extract cartographical data from computers in the home electronics section.
Journal entry of Rebecca East Oda.
Next day, i.e., Saturday after Thanksgiving. Temperature 39 degrees Fahrenheit. Our dining area has been designated a war room and is now matted with cables of various descriptions. Most of these have something to do with Mortimer's efforts to boot up the new Grimnir system, which is going to be his improvised ragtag replacement for Odin. It runs on something called the Dark Net, of which the less said, the better.
fielded a telephone call from a representative of the cable television company, complaining that we have been making all sorts of connections to dodgy servers and are in danger of having our service cut off, played the little old lady card. Feigned ignorance, requested technical support, which I knew would hold them off for days. A few years ago, when we dug the book out of the vegetable garden and made all of that money and transferred the property to the East House Trust and ceased to become its legal owners, it felt as if I had sawed my right leg off, but only for a few days. When it became obvious that this made absolutely no practical difference, I forgot it had happened. Since then, it has only entered my awareness when we receive a property tax bill or some such, and I see the official name on the address label. Today, however, it is much on my mind, as it gives me a sort of detached emotional status from which to view all of these goings-on. SUVs, obviously belonging to some sort of government agency, are parked on the streets around us, drawing comment from the neighbors. Presumably they are spying on us, but they make no effort to cross the property line. At 2 in the morning, 3 people climbed over the back fence and caused us all sorts of alarm before we recognized them. Felix Dorn, Esme Ulferkleeft, and Julie Lee. They had got together for late-night drinks at the Apostolic Café and made the decision to defect from Dodo to join our little ragtag reboot thereof, Julie being the obvious instigator given her romance with Mortimer. Then they all stayed up all night talking. Now they are sleeping in shifts in May's old room, the guest room, and the floor of my sewing room. Chira Lajani, they report, counts herself among us in spirit, but dares not defect openly from Dodo, lest it interfere with her younger siblings' immigration status. She might be able to function as a mole, but these are early days yet. From them we were able to get more news of what has been going on at the Walmart. Our access to the message traffic on the Odin system was of course cut off the moment Mortimer left the building, and since then we were limited to what we could glean from television news reports and internet rumors. The powers that be at Dodo, which by this point basically means Grania, since she seems to control Blevins absolutely, are not even aware that Felix, Esme, and Julie have come over to our side, and may not appreciate that fact until the 3 of them fail to show up for work on Monday morning. In the meantime, they still have access to the Odin system over their phones. This has enabled us to solve a riddle that bedeviled our minds from the very beginning of Magnus's siege at the Walmart. Clearly, Magnus made the rounds of the Viking world and recruited a sort of all-star team of marauders who were willing to follow his lead. And on one level it makes sense for them to raid a Walmart, which to them would be a poorly guarded storehouse of near infinite wealth. But beyond that, it makes no sense at all. They must either stay in the present or return to the past via the Atto. If they stay in the present, they will inevitably be caught, tried, and put in prison. Magnus must know this. If they return to the past, they'll do so naked and empty-handed. Why, therefore, go to the effort of sacking a Walmart and gathering loot they can't take with them? Magnus must understand this, too. According to the over-the-fence gang, Julie, Felix, and Esme, the answer was pieced together yesterday afternoon by the Dosecops people who have access to surveillance camera footage from the Walmart. As soon as they had the electronics department fortified behind plywood and blue tarps and their hostages secured, except for the one unfortunate who was rolled out into the parking lot after being blood-eagled, Magnus raided the pharmacy section and secured a large amount of lidocaine, which is a topical anesthetic. In the meanwhile, Some of the hostages were being chained to computers in the electronics section and put to work downloading information on certain topics. To make a long story short, it appears that during his sojourn in the present day, Magnus became aware of the fact that the New World contained an amount of gold and silver that was beyond the dreams of the most avaricious Vikings. Their longships were perfectly capable of making the voyage across the Atlantic by hopping from Iceland to Greenland to Newfoundland and thence down the coast. What they lacked was information. Nautical charts showing the way and land maps of Mexico and Peru and other gold-rich areas. And so this is a sort of information that the hostages were put to work downloading and printing out on paper. Magnus's Vikings then took turns lying face down on the floor. Lidocaine was smeared on their bare backs and the treasure maps carved into their skin using hobby knives from the store's art supply section. This procedure has apparently been going on all night. When the Dosekops people understood what was going on, they cut power to the building. But the Vikings were ready for that, with candles and lamps from the camping section, and by then they had already printed out everything they needed on paper. The Atto has its own built-in power supply capable of running for days. Frank made sure of that. One of Dodo's spy drones has been circling above the store and has been picking up bursts of glamour, suggesting that some of the Vikings are already being sent back. So they must have a witch among them who is ensconced in the Atto doing the sending, and God only knows what else. All of this information is several hours old, and I'm writing it late, Saturday morning. The television news shows no change in status at the Walmart, which of course doesn't reflect what might be happening within the Atto. The police haven't raided yet. No hostages have been released. It is a standoff. It appears that what is going to happen, or already has happened many centuries ago, on this or some other strand, is that Magnus's band of all-star berserkers will end up in 10th century Scandinavia with detailed maps carved into their backs, showing them how to traverse the Atlantic and Caribbean and sack the Americas for their unimaginable wealth of precious metals, then bring it all back to Scandinavia, or anywhere else they feel like living. It is difficult to see how this could be stopped. Dodo could send some doers even further back in time to try to change history to somehow foil Magnus's plan. But two can play at that game. Magnus can just as well send people further back yet to intercept the doers, and so on. Needless to say, any strand on which Magnus's plan succeeds will have a very different future from the one we are living in. Tristan is of the opinion that Dodo's spy planes are probably flying high above Mexico City and Cusco at this moment, looking for signs of glamour, indicating the temporal equivalent of a nuclear strike. We all wish Melisande were among us to help us think it all through. Unfortunately, she remains marooned. Mortimer, logging in to Odin through Esme's phone, has been able to pull up some message traffic confirming that Grania sent Mel to Victorian London in the summer of 1851, only weeks before the eclipse that marked the end of magic. By that time, the few remaining witches who could do magic at all were much enfeebled, especially in London, as that's where the Great Exhibition was, and thus there was an immense concentration of magic-dampening technology all amassed in one place. So, there is great concern that even if Mel were able to land on her feet in that detap and make contact with a practicing witch, it would be too late to get her back. In any case, there is little we can do except try to provide a place for her to land. If she materializes in one of the existing Odeks, she'll immediately be in Grania's power. So we need to build or obtain an Odek of our own. Frank, who has spent the last couple of years designing and constructing room-temperature odecks, is, of course, the leading authority in the world when it comes to that. He seems to have had a premonition of what was to come. Or perhaps he received a warning from the future. For he has for the last few weeks been laying plans to improvise a room-temperature odec in our cellar. Many of the parts, he says, can be obtained from Home Depot, but others are highly specialized, including room-temperature superconductors that are easy to obtain with the resources of Dodo at one's back, but almost impossible for mere civilians to acquire. Update. Written late Saturday. Television reveals that the siege has been lifted. The Walmart was stormed by SWAT teams after several hours had gone by with no sign of activity. The hostages were found bound and gagged with duct tape, but otherwise unharmed. No arrests have been made. Police are claiming that the perpetrators made their escape from the building by crawling along a sewer line, or some such nonsense. On the television footage, which is all shot from a distance, using drones and helicopters with long lenses, it's possible to see two different groups of officers inside the Walmart. The local police SWAT team, which is roaming all over the store, and Dodo's EFOT squad, whose existence we've all just learned about this weekend, sort of Dos Equis on steroids, which has surrounded the tractor-trailer rig and is not allowing anyone else near it. Apparently, the tractor and trailer were so badly damaged as to be unusable. Now, however, another tractor-trailer has showed up in the parking lot, as well as some sort of enormous forklift from Massport that is capable of picking the Atto off of the one and transferring it to the other. I'm sure that the Atto is about to disappear into the bowels of the military-industrial complex, never to be seen again.
Exchange of posts on Addo Operations Odin Channel. Day 1949, Sunday after Thanksgiving, Year 5. Note, posts recovered from a telephone belonging to Julie Lee, who had access to Odin until the following day. Post from Major Isobel Sloan, 016.
Here is yet another update. Hopefully the last, from the Walmart. The obstructions that have been preventing the forklift from getting into the building were finally cleared away about an hour ago. We've had to work around the police crime scene teams. Since there is no particular urgency, we have taken a go-along-get-along approach, which is why it has been so slow. They were irritated by our insistence on padlocking the Atto the moment we arrived and keeping people out of it, but thanks to some calls from on high... Kudos to Lieutenant General Frink, I suppose. They eventually got the message that the Atto was a no-go area on national security grounds. The forklift is now maneuvering into position alongside the tractor-trailer and getting ready to move the Atto.
Reply from Lieutenant General Frink, 021.
Thank you, Major Sloan. Despite the late hour, I am monitoring from my office at the Pentagon. What is the status of the Atto itself? Has it suffered any damage?
From Major Sloan, 030.
It took superficial damage. One good reason for housing it in a beefy steel shipping container. From the fact that Magnus's team were successfully sent into it and later homed, we have ample evidence that it remains fully operational. The external status lights all show green. By the way, I don't know if you have video feed on this, but the forklift has removed it from the ruined rig now and is taking it into the parking lot. Should have it on the good rig in a couple of minutes.
From Lieutenant General Frank, 035.
Do we know how Magnus's personnel were homed?
From Major Sloan, 037.
Haven't had time to do a full after-action report. We'll analyze it. Presumably, they had their own Muon in the Atto, and she homed them one by one after they had the maps cut in their backs.
From Lieutenant General Frank, 040.
Is Dr. Blevins awake and monitoring this? I feel the need of some expert opinions. My understanding is that Muons cannot send or home themselves. Some other Muon must do it for them.
From Major Sloan, 045.
Addo is now on the Goodrig, and the truck driver is conducting